Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung. Optimism or pragmatism?
Optimism.
Celebrity or practically?
Practically.
Theory or practice?
I would say theory and practice. To do something, you have to have an idea behind it, research, understanding. And the strength of actions come from good theories or good knowledge, good research. So those would be together.
Today, architecture is tasked with doing more and more than in the past. More than ever before, architecture and design are necessary if we are to propose real alternatives for the global challenges we face. Gone are the days of the lone hero or architect as artist or one-dimensional professional. Those involved in architecture, landscape architecture, and urbanism must understand and respond to complex issues and ever-increasing challenges. These words come from Martha Thorne, who has spent many years of her professional career organizing, awarding, and judging architectural prizes, and who remains fascinated by the awards, their mission, how they work, and their impact. From 2005 to 2021, she was the executive director of the Pritzker Architecture Prize, also known as the Nobel Prize for Architecture, and is currently senior advisor to the Henrik F. Obel Foundation, which presents the Obel Award. In today's podcast, me, Diana Slavich, and Eva Herrmann talk to Martha Thorne about what is special about this award and where we still need to rethink.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's Jung Talks podcast. Martha, we are glad to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be with you and to be engaging with your audience as well.
The Pritzker Prize is a really big deal, the dream of generations of architects. So take us a bit behind the scenes. How do you get a nomination and what is the process like?
The Pritzker Prize, of course, started in 1979, so you're absolutely right. It is one of the long-standing awards in the field of architecture. And it does work differently than other prizes. The nominations procedure is open, so anyone can send a name to the executive director. And the nominations process is also solicited nominations. When I was executive director, I sent out hundreds of letters or emails to different people around the world, asking them who they thought would be a good candidate for the award. It's different than some awards because there's no entry fee, there's no long list of documents that people present. Someone can just send the name of someone. And the way that I worked, I always said, if you think that the name is not known well to the jury, then please send a bibliography, a website, or some information that would allow us to do the research to find out more information about the nominee. And the other interesting thing about the Pritzker that I appreciate very much is that they don't award for photographs. They visit buildings around the world. They do this together, but the members of the jury also do it on their own. And therefore, they have a lot of firsthand knowledge about the buildings, the spaces, how they're used, how they function. And that informs the decision that they eventually make all together around the table.
That's really exciting because the field is huge. If you can send in recommendations, and not really good to compare. So it's exciting that the jury can agree on one candidate. How long is the process?
Well, I always like to say when I was involved with the organization, it's like electing a pope. It takes as long as it takes until the white smoke goes up. I was so fortunate to be in the jury meetings. However, I limited my role to answering questions, providing information if asked, but I did not volunteer opinions. That was not my role. But sitting in on the jury meetings, it was fascinating. Usually they started the discussion in a very broad way. What happened in the past year? Where is architecture going? What are some of the challenges of the field? Have they experienced anything new and exciting they wanted to share with each other? And basically, they would go around the table and everyone had an equal opportunity and equal time to speak. And little by little, over the hours, over the days, they would be able to focus in on the most crucial issues that were reflected that year and through the nominees. And then they came to a decision. And I have to say, I always saw that the decision was unanimous because it wasn't a question of voting. It wasn't a question of ticking boxes, but it was a question of getting to a deeper understanding of who the architect or architects were that were nominated. And it was also a big concern, especially in the later years, about the message of the prize. What would it be saying if it chose this person or that person or this team? What would be the message that the public would receive? And would that be something, a message that would have impact and could influence the profession in the future? So that for me was particularly exciting to sit in on those meetings. And I have to say the most eloquent people around the table also knew how to listen very carefully to others. And as you know, the jury was quite varied, practicing architects, business people, critics, academics, curators. We even had a Supreme Court judge on the jury, who acted as a client for some buildings and therefore represented the public.
That's so cool. So the awarding of the Pritzker Prize to, for example, Alejandro Aravena or Grafton Architects or Lacaton Vassal marked the beginning of a new era?
I think it's difficult to say there's a new era or an old era. And I say that because all prizes, they go sort of back and forth. They're like a pendulum that swings one way and another way. What I can mention is from the conversations of the jury, clearly over the years that I was there, the dialogues, the conversations became much greater, much more enlarged in terms of the themes. So social responsibility, contribution to the community, process of design and construction. It often focused on public buildings or buildings that had a civic element to them, as opposed to private buildings. But I think that also reflected this enlarged idea of new themes that tried to make architecture in the service of a broader community, not just one client or one family.
Now, we've talked about the Pritzker Prize. Let's move to the Obel Award, which is a new international architecture prize that honors outstanding contemporary architectural contributions to human development worldwide. You are moving from the Nobel Prize of Architecture, which is awarded to individuals, to specific projects that contribute to the community. Isn't it quite a contrast?
It's a huge contrast because identifying a person, there's always a story behind that person, a personality, influences, their growth and development as an individual. On the other hand, if we really look carefully at architecture, we realize it's never an individual endeavor. It's always part of a team, whether that team is in the office with consultants or also including the clients, those who will use the building, the people who will construct it, and the people who will maintain it and care for it in the future. So there's a huge group. We could even say it's an army of people for every building. And in that sense, I think that the Pritzker, by shining a light on an individual or individuals, is highlighting the individual story, the talent that human beings can bring to a project. On the other hand, the Obel Award looks at a project and therefore I think has a difficult task, but what it is trying to do is to see how can a project give a message, how can it modify an environment or modify the thinking of the people in that community. And really, in the end, it doesn't matter so much who has designed and constructed the building. To me, I think it matters that the building serves the community, serves a purpose. It can be something that is appreciated over many years, flexible enough so it can adapt to the changing needs of the society, the needs of the planet. And therefore, I think the emphasis on the initiative, the project, the element of the physical environment is more difficult, but has a message of optimism, if we go back to that first word, optimism and change in the future. How can we make architecture, how can we make the built environment more meaningful and relevant to people and the planet?
You know so many architects, so many projects worldwide. Is there any special project that you would like to tell us?
Well, when I look at the Obel Award, it's only 5 years old, so it's quite young. I would say that last year's winner, which was Living Breakwaters, this is a project to reconstruct the coastline of Staten Island. It's in some ways a pilot project to reduce the risk of flooding, of hurricanes. I think it's a project that combines design, nature, and climate change all in one. And in that sense, I was surprised because living in Europe, I'm not so close to what's happening in the U.S. On the other hand, because it is a project for Staten Island, for one of the boroughs of New York City, it was very relevant to me. It was very meaningful knowing that Hurricane Sandy had destroyed so much of the coastline of that island where many people lived, and thinking that, well, if we can use design, if we can use nature, and if we can see our role as bringing those together in a positive way so that we can reduce the risks of climate change, not completely ameliorate them, not to get rid of them completely because climate change is continuing, it's getting worse, but if we can empower the physical environment, the community, to be able to work together with nature and to preserve our natural environments and our built environments, then I think that's something that reflects probably the best of architecture, which would be solving several problems through one movement, one gesture, one project, and doing it not just for the short term, but also for medium and long term. The other interesting thing that I find about an award like the Obel Award is that it's very future looking. It's not something looking to the past, to what has been done, but it's often architectures that have an element of risk, that are looking at new problems or problems that may happen in the future again and again, and therefore trying to tackle those, trying to approach those in a way where the knowledge gained from this first project could then be put into a feedback loop, so to speak, or used in future projects, and therefore improving and improving and going deeper and more consistently using those ideas and developing them for the future.
So it's important for architecture as, let me say, a service for society and nature to honor both the creators and the projects, to bring the projects and the people to a broader audience. But there is an infinite number of architectural awards and the numbers increasing. So is there still the benefit of showcasing the projects, or are the awards losing their value and also their recognition? as a result?
I have to say, I think that with the huge number of awards that we see nowadays, the jury is still out about the true value of those awards. The way that I look at awards is first I ask, who is behind it? What is the purpose? And often there are several purposes to awards. I look for awards that are trying to make some sort of change, trying to get us to debate something, to think of something in a new way that would help us tackle some of these ever-increasing problems that we're facing. I also look at awards that do recognize talent, human talent. I don't think architecture is just a functional service. It's just to make places, to house people, to protect nature, to provide an office. I think architecture is much more than that. And therefore, I think that awards that can somehow do both, which would be have a positive impact for the future and also recognize the human talent that goes into thinking about these new ideas, is the way to go. I'm a little skeptical about awards that come from companies or publications and that they may have an entry fee. You don't really know who the jury is. You don't know the criteria. Those awards are often self-serving for the organization or for the person. I also think we're kind of in a bind because there are sometimes architectural competitions or when you're looking for a job in the field, they ask, what awards have you won? And I think that this is kind of a superficial measure because not all awards are the same. Not all have the same criteria. On the other hand, if I have to say something positive about awards, the positive thing is when they encourage the general public to talk about them and not just talk about the clothes that an architect wears or the hairstyle or something very superficial. But if an award is granted and the public is able to say, I agree, I disagree for this reason or that reason, then I think it does have great value. Architecture is very hard for the public to become engaged with on a very personal level. And I'm sure you've heard me say, how many times do you go to a dentist a year? Well, we all have an opinion about dentists. How many times do you go to an architect over the course of your life? Well, we don't have that firsthand experience in many cases, and therefore we don't have an opinion or knowledge about what architects do or what they could be doing. So therefore, awards can help the general public become closer to architects, their work, and also get involved in the debate about where the profession should be going, where is it going, what they would like to see. So in that sense, I think the jury is out. I'm not sure what will happen over the next 10 years. I'm hoping that there are not more and more awards because I think it's just a lot of static in the background and can be confusing.
Let's see if your wish comes true. At the moment, it looks like more and more awards are coming up for very different reasons and from very different directions. But let's go back to the Obel Award and this year's theme, which is Architecture With. What does Architecture With mean?
That's a very good question. And I think that's the beauty of one of those questions that the Obel often poses. Architectures With can mean architectures within an office with professionals from other sectors. For example, if you're working on restoration, you could have an archaeologist, you could have a restoration specialist, a historian. It could mean architectures with looking at those involved who would be stakeholders in the community, not asking them to design a building, but listening to them. What are their hopes? What is the way they want to live in the future? How do they live now? What could a new facility mean? Architectures with the client. And I like to say this, especially in public buildings, because often the client, when it's a public entity, they allow the architect, well, just go ahead and do the project. When really the best clients are the ones who are step by step involved in the dialogue of the essence of the project, the meaning, how long it will last, what can it do beyond providing that functional facility for the city or the town. So I think architectures with puts the architect more in the role of citizen, not just a professional doing something for a person, but rather a team member, a citizen as well as a professional. And I think also having a more meaningful relationship with clients and listening to potential stakeholders or imagining potential stakeholders in the future means with. It's not just a top-down, here it is, take my idea, this is my artistic concept, do it. But it's rather a much more horizontal. Democratic, not from the point of view of voting which color, which style, which this, which that, but democratic from the point of view of listening and valuing the ideas and the opinions of others. I think architectures with is based on the premise of more voices, more input can create a much better project than one person alone could do. So it's that idea of listening and of gaining new knowledge and new ideas from many different areas within and without the profession.
It's exciting that you interpret the topic so openly, because that opens the door for some new solutions. And the responsibility of architects has never been greater. So we need to act quickly to address the fragility and challenges of our society and the built environment. An hour ago, I watched the TED talk of Johan Rockström about the climate change and bad surprises, that it's getting faster. So we have to act really quick. Mm-hmm. And in a TED talk, you talked about agents of change. So what do they represent for you?
The concept of agents of change, I'm not sure exactly where that came from in my life. Perhaps because my father was an immigrant and changed countries at a very young age. Perhaps because I've lived in different places and have had to change or wanted to change my residence. But I think agents of change, it's a very optimistic idea that the world is changing, the world is evolving, and therefore we have an opportunity as well as a responsibility to be part of that change. I think the idea of going back to a past, the idea of the good old days were in the past and we want to go back, that's absolutely absurd. We know that there is climate change, but we also know that there are technological changes. When I started my career, I didn't use a cell phone. Now I do all the time, as many people. There are many new inventions, many new ideas, much more new knowledge. And so I think that agents of change are the people who embrace this, embrace the knowledge, and say, let's find a better way to do, or let's try a better way to do things. Of course, we need to rely on knowledge that we've gained in the past. Of course, we need to have memory. We're part of a lineage from prehistory to now. We're not new inventions. On the other hand, if we recognize that the context is in constant change, it's a dynamic context, then why shouldn't we also not be victims of that change, but embrace it and be agents of change, contributing positively to where we're going?
We found a LinkedIn post from you where you're saying that for cities to reach their full potential, we need to adopt a more dynamic, multidisciplinary way of designing and planning them. And again, in a TED talk, you talked about Dieter Rams and his 10 principles of good design. So where can we still learn principles for the changing roles?
I do remember the TED talk in Dieter Rams. I think the beauty of his approach to design was through simplicity, through understanding how people use elements or intuitively could use different appliances or inventions in the home. And he never added something extra in a frivolous way. So I like to look at his ideas. You couldn't add anything and make it better, and you couldn't take away anything to make it better. So I think cities are sort of in the same situation. That said, how can cities realize their full potential? I think we have some difficulties in cities, starting with the structure of the governing bodies. It's always been easier to divide the government in the tax department, the streets and sanitation department, the building department, the education, the hospitals. But if we really look at how things work, and each and every person saw this during COVID, that the definition of our home or our work or healthcare or education was no longer fragmented the way it had been in the past in an effort to understand those different roles. When COVID hit, everything was thrown together and we had to deal with in the best way we could. How do we homeschool? Do we work from home? Do we go someplace? What about transportation? Do we take public transportation in terms of health? How do vaccines and masks, how can they help us? What are some of the issues that people are concerned about, the fears, the emotions? With the experience of COVID, it became very real to me, the interconnections between the physical environment, health, education, work, economics, emotions. And therefore, I think that if we continue to try to define cities as physical plans drawn on a paper or sectors where you have the industrial zone, the housing zone, or if we allow developers to think that their role is a business to make money for their stakeholders and they neglect the future of the city, the vision of the city, the emotions of the future residents, the affordability, then I think if we look only one-dimensionally at those things, we're never going to have cities that are livable cities, inclusive cities, where we really take advantage of the talent of the individuals who work there in a more efficient and fulfilling way. So when I talk about cities and finding their full potential, I know it's messy. I know everything connected to everything can be just a huge big ball of wax, a lot of knots coming together. But I also think that if we recognize that cities are complex and we try to ask the right questions, gather the right data, and even I would venture, create digital twins for parts of the cities to look at how certain moves, certain new ideas might impact the traffic, the health, the education, the physical environment, the air quality. Then I think we're starting to harness the power of our knowledge, harness the power of our technology, and recognize the reality that everything is connected.
Thanks to your various roles, from organizing an award till teaching, you have a great overview about all these topics. And with this overview, but also your network, you can address individual topics and perhaps also promote them.
I think that any job, any position can be creative. Lots of people say, oh, I don't have a creative job. I'm just an accountant. I'm just a programmer. I think creativity is not the domain of one profession like an artist or an architect. And I think also that we can have an impact in almost any job that we do or any position we're in. I think this depends more on finding common values with the organization, with the foundation, with the company, with the academic institution. And if you find that common ground and can keep your eye on the path towards the future, it's never going to be a straight path. It's always going to be a sinuous path with detours. On the other hand, I think that we need to have that motivation in any job that we do. It's the passion. I think we know it's not enough just to be appreciated by a boss. It's not enough just to take the paycheck home every month. For people to be fulfilled, they need to feel useful. They need to feel helpful. They need to feel that they're contributing something beyond themselves. And I think education is a place where that happens very directly because we're in contact with students. We're talking about policies. We're talking about direction of studies. We're trying to make change in how things have been done for over 100 years in architecture. So in that sense, I think any job can contribute to this bigger issue. That's not to say that I can prescribe that everyone should follow my path. Of course not. But in education, one thing I found which was so fulfilling is with the broadening of the field of architecture and design, the students at my school here in Madrid, where I was able to be dean for 7 years, the message always to those students was, learn all you can, because the path to the future, you have to define that path. And the context will change, but if you've defined your path in terms of values, in terms of passion, in terms of what you believe in, then you probably won't have a problem finding a job that pays the rent.
So this is encouraging on one hand, but on the other hand, it makes us all responsible for our environment and everything.
Absolutely.
So let's move to another important issue. Today, we are three women in this podcast. Let's talk about diversity and equality. You talked about to be passionate about something, but I don't think that's enough to be passionate. What's about the role of women in architecture? What do you think are the challenges today and what needs to change?
I totally agree with you. Passion, blind passion is not enough. I used to like to say to my students and my team, please don't give me ideas every day. I have 100 ideas. Give me a good idea and a strategy to implement it. So passion is not enough. We need that strategy to implement. When you talk about women in architecture, this is a question that I really appreciate. In general, in Europe and in the United States and North America, women came late to the profession of architecture. It's not a profession that allowed women to join. They were not allowed in schools. And because of our historical context, the physical environment, the construction of it was seen as unladylike. It was not something that women should be doing. There are different periods in history. Of course, we know when women were called to factories. We know when women were encouraged to stay home and have children. In different countries, it may be slightly different, but in general, the field of architecture has not been open and equitable to women. It's trying to be more so nowadays than it was in the past. That has to do with historical reasons. It has to do with cultural reasons. It has to do with power. I think that women are still in the great minority. They're certainly not in positions of responsibility in architectural firms to the same extent that men are. We know that women on the construction site are not respected in the same way that men are. We know that the numbers of women in construction are very, very small compared to the number of men who work on construction sites. So the whole physical environment, and especially architecture, is one that needs to look to the future and needs to realize that with more knowledge and more voices and more talent, 50% of the population, it will do a much better job of creating a healthy, healthful, sustainable, beautiful, functional environment. So what can women do? I think this depends on the context that women find themselves in. I think it depends on the point in their career. I like to tell my students, although the university may seem like a very equitable place where you have lots of opportunity, don't be fooled. Always keep your guard up, keep your eyes open, because the real world has many, many people and many different agendas, and it's not clear that everyone shares an agenda of equality. That's for students. I think when people are professionals working, anything they can do to foster communication with other women, not always agreeing, but you can always enter into dialogue in a respectful way with other women. That forms a community of women. So I know in the past, many women in offices have felt isolated, have felt misunderstood, or have felt that they needed to adopt a role more similar to the traditional male models. I think women in profession nowadays have more liberty, and they have the power to engage with other women. And that forms a community of mutual support. It also gives a message to the men that they cannot be isolated. They cannot be alone. I think there are individual things that women can do in practice, learn techniques of public speaking, learn how to approach their superiors, ask for raises, continue studying, becoming specialists in a certain field that could contribute and gain them recognition in the office, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that for those of us who have had really privileged and long careers, we're in a special position because we can raise our voices without fear of reprisal, or the reprisals don't mean so much. So I think nowadays, the discrimination that women feel in architecture and the professions related to the built environment is very subtle. And it may be something as simple as an entity organizing an invited competition, and they invite all male architects to this competition. Well, if you're invited to be a jury member, then you can say, if it's all men in the competition, I will not be on the jury. Or if it's all men on the scientific committee of this conference, I will not participate. And then if you're really bold, like I am sometimes, I say, I won't participate, and I'm going to go to the press and tell them that you're doing things in an undemocratic way, in a 19th century way, not a 21st century way. So please rethink your position. That directness and that method of calling one's bluff is something that not everyone can do. And I recognize that some people need to get up every day and they need to go to their job and they can't always risk things. But I think we can all risk a little bit. And I think those of us in certain positions should be risking more. And I have to mention one other award. I know we've talked about awards, but the DIVI Award, which is Diversity in Architecture, it's a new award, relatively new. They've had one winner. I was approached by the founder of this award in the beginning, and I sort of said, no, 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 another award, we don't need it. But this woman was so devoted and so profound in her approach and research. When she came back to me and said, would you be on the jury? I couldn't refuse. I saw the list of nominees that come from experts around the world. And I have to say, of all the finalists, I think I may have known of two or three from the whole list. And I realized that I myself, although I speak out in favor of women, I didn't always know the extent that women were working, especially in Asia and Africa, the incredible work that they're doing there, and not always in a traditional sense, but in many fields of the built environment. So I joined this prize as a member of the jury, and it's every 2 years. And it's run on a shoestring of lots of hard work and passion by the organizers. But I think it's going to make a difference because it's educating all of us to the examples of talent in unknown places or places that are far away from Western Europe. I think it's giving a message, especially to younger students of architecture, of the breadth and the width, the great width of the field. And I'm very optimistic about the impact it will have for these women to be recognized even more in their communities and beyond. So I'm very passionate about it, but I also try to be strategic and realistic. We have a long way to go.
Thanks so much, Martha, for all your insights. We are coming to the end of our podcast, and to conclude it, we have one final personal question to you. Dead or alive, who do you admire right now and why?
I'm not sure if this is politically correct, but I'm going to say Kamala Harris. I'll tell you why. Here is someone who was vice president in the United States, number two, a woman in a position of number two. She was rather silent for these past 4 years. And when President Biden decided not to run for office, the first comment was, nobody knows Kamala Harris. She hasn't done anything. Nobody wants her. The reason I select her is because she represents to me one of those women who is unstoppable. Even if you haven't seen her for a few years, from the way she speaks, from her understanding of the issues, from her choice of running mate, from her savviness in politics, you know that she has been working all these years, building up her knowledge, asking hard questions of herself and those around her. And she is more than ready to take the next step in politics for a country that I think was mired in the past. So in that sense, she represents a person of hope. She represents change. And she represents that you don't always have to be a boisterous, out there star to continue to do your homework, prepare yourself, delve into the issues, and be ready when your opportunity comes along. So I like that, breaking the mold, the male mold, and she is creating her own mold, and I think is pretty inspiring for other women. So quiet work sometimes is the way to go, and then when the opportunity permits, come on out and do your stuff.
And to say it like Obama, yes, she can.
Yes, she can.
I read this morning in the newspaper. He said, yes, she can. So that's great.
Absolutely.
So, Martha, that's a very nice way to end up our discussion. a woman. We closed the circles many times. So thank you very much for your time and your inspiring words. It's goodbye from us until the next episode of the Jung Talks, the Jung Architectural Podcast.